Where were you when something happened? It's a powerful question sometimes, particularly when we think of great events, world-changing events, events that changed our lives, events that knock us over a bit. Where were you when JFK was shot? Where were you when the Twin Towers were attacked on 9/11? Where were you when the February earthquake struck in Christchurch? Or when the mosque attack happened? And most people can tell you where they were when those things happened or when they heard about them, if they were alive at the time. Even more so, they can tell you where they were if they were involved in the event or in close proximity to it, as is the case for some of us with the earthquakes or with the mosque shooting even. I want to ask a question a little bit like that today, a kind of where were you question. But it's a strange one in a way, because I want to ask it about the passage from the Bible, from Luke's Gospel, which we heard just now. In that story, where were you? Now, obviously, that's a strange question, given it's a story that recounts events that happened 2,000 years ago. So if I ask, where were you? You'd probably say, nowhere. Not even a twinkle in my great-great-great-grandfather's eye. But still, I think if we look carefully enough, we will actually find ourselves in this passage in one or more places. We'll find ourselves in or among the different groups of people in this powerful story. So as we look carefully at it, let me ask you, where were you in this story? Where were you indeed in this trial scene? Because above all, that's what this passage is. We're in Luke's Gospel, starting at chapter 22, big number 22, but actually we're closer to the end of chapter 22, the verse 63, which is the little numbers, the verses, are quite near the end of this chapter. If you have a Bible open, it will help you here. But as I say, this is a trial scene, or in some ways a series of trial scenes. And it's Jesus who's on trial. Jesus, who we've followed through Luke's Gospel, as John said, who's been at the center of the story that Luke's been telling us, who's done these extraordinary things throughout the Gospel, astonishing and rich teaching, incredible deeds, a healing and helping people who are in great need, finding those who are lost, bringing in those who are on the outside. But last week, we saw that he was betrayed by a friend and handed over to the Jewish leaders, the leaders of his own people, that is, who wanted to get rid of him. And we saw that he was betrayed in a different way by another of his closest friends, Peter, who denied that he even knew Jesus. And so now, Jesus is alone in the hands of his enemies. And that's where our scene starts in verse 63. Just hear that first verse again. The men who were guarding Jesus began mocking and beating him. Now these men who were guarding him make sport of him. And while the beating was horrible, and we get some idea of how horrible it is as we look through the Gospels, while it was horrible, it's the mocking which Luke emphasizes. Jesus had shown himself to have an extraordinary connection to God. He was a prophet and more. But they make fun of that in verse 64. Prophet. In verse 65, they say many insulting things. And in the original language, the word for insult and for blasphemy is the same. So, in a sense, they're saying many blasphemous things to him as they mock him, treating the one who has shown love to the outcast and mercy to the hurting in a divine way, treating him like he is dirt. Show us who the prophet is now. Prophet, holy man. I wonder if any of you see yourself in the soldiers at all. Whether yourself now, or maybe even at an earlier time of life. An attitude of outright mockery to Jesus. It's not actually uncommon to see. How are you Christians? You worship a zombie raised from the dead. All this Son of God stuff, ridiculous. Bronze Age beliefs. Come up, join us in the 21st century for goodness sake. Were you there among the soldiers? Or perhaps you're there among the Jewish leaders, which is what we come to next. Jesus is brought in to his first trial in verse 66 before the council of the elders, that is the Sanhedrin, council of the Jewish leadership. In verse 67, they ask Jesus to tell them if he is the Messiah or the Christ, that is God's promised king. And Jesus' answer from sort of halfway through verse 67 is sort of cryptic. Have another look with me. Halfway through verse 67, Jesus answered, "If I tell you, you will not believe me, and if I asked you, you would not answer." In effect, he's saying, you're not actually looking for an answer. You're not looking for the truth. If I tell you who I am, you won't accept it anyway. If I ask you questions, if I try to enter into a real discussion with you, you won't answer. You're not after the truth. You just want to hear what you want to hear. Indeed, Jesus had asked some of these leaders questions before, earlier in the gospel, and they wouldn't answer. They didn't actually want a discussion with Jesus. And here, Jesus shows that they're not really asking a question. Not really. Not an honest question. It's more like the kind of question a tabloid journalist who smells blood in the water and a story in the offering, more like the kind of question that kind of journalist would ask a politician. It's not about getting to the truth. It's about getting some dirt we can pin on them. That's what they're doing here. And the great problem with that here is that by taking that attitude, the leaders have ruled out of court the one answer that is true. That's what he in effect tells them. With his words about sitting at the right hand of God, which he says in verse 69, which in turn they draw a picture from Psalm 110 in the Old Testament, and that psalm points towards the Messiah. And so Jesus, by saying that, he's effectively saying, I am the Messiah, even though you refuse to recognize it right now. You'll see it one day. And then in verse 70, Jesus answers another question of theirs, and he says, you say that I am. By saying that, he's slightly enigmatically confirming their question about him being the Son of God. And they recognize that because they make it clear in verse 71 that they think by doing that he's condemned himself here. See, they will not accept the possibility that he might actually be the Messiah and the Son of God. The one thing they would not entertain is that it would be true that he is the Messiah and the Son of God. They'll ask questions, but they won't entertain that possibility. Do you see yourself in the leaders at all? Again, this is a common attitude. Some people do ask questions about Jesus. They kind of seem interested, but they're actually only interested in looking for reasons to reject him. Because they've already decided that he can't be who he claims to be. How could he? After all, as the journalist Molly Worthen said, if it turns out he is who he is, then I have to change my working hypothesis of the universe. That can't be right. And that would include, of course, changing the way I see myself and changing the way of who I see who's in charge of my life. That can't be right. And so questions get asked, but not with an honest openness to Jesus actually being who he claimed to be. Mind you, that's kind of more skeptical people. Christians fall into something similar at times in a slightly different way. And looking at something that Jesus says to us through the Bible or in some part of the scriptures, either says to us directly or through his prophets or through his apostles, and we say, oh, well, it can't really be that, can it? Because I've always believed it's this other thing. So even if it says that, that can't be right. Because if I accept that, if I'm corrected by what he says here, then I'd have to change something I've believed for many years. And I'd have to admit I was wrong. I might even have to change some area of the way I live my life. I wouldn't want to do that, so it can't be that. So I might ask what it says, but I don't really want an answer. Were you there among the leaders? I was. What about among the people and Pilate? That's where we head to next. Both of these kind of cover two sections of this passage, so we'll look at them in two goes. Particularly Pilate in the first one and then both in the second. In chapter 23, verse 1, next to the big number 23 now. Jesus is taken from the Sanhedrin, the Jewish council, to Pilate, and Pilate's the Roman governor. Because Israel were under Roman rule, so the Jewish leaders probably couldn't legally sentence someone to death. They needed to take him to Pilate for that. And so the charges against them come out in verse 2. The charges against Jesus come out in verse 2. Firstly, the leaders accuse him before Pilate of subverting the nation, causing trouble like a revolutionary or a rebel. You know, he's causing trouble. He's subverting things. Secondly, they accuse him of opposing payment of taxes to Caesar, which is a lie. Because actually, when he was asked about taxes, he said, give to Caesar what is Caesar's. We saw that some weeks ago. But thirdly, they accuse him of claiming to be the Messiah, which is true. But they are clever lawyers at this point, because they make sure that Pilate knows that the Messiah, that's a king. And that means a rival to Caesar, the emperor. And Caesar is Pilate's boss. So Pilate, you better do something about this. This guy's a rival to your boss. Well, verse 3, Pilate asks Jesus if he is indeed the king. And Jesus is kind of enigmatic again. You have said so. But despite the clever accusations of the Jewish leaders, Pilate can see through it. He can see. So he gives a verdict to both the leaders and the crowd that is gathered. In verse 4, he says, I find no basis for a charge against this man. It's very clear, isn't it? Still, verse 5, they insist. No, Jesus is stirring up the people. He's causing trouble. He has been doing that, they say, since he came from Galilee, the area in the north where Jesus grew up. He's been stirring them up all the way from there. And at that point, Pilate sees an opportunity, probably a double opportunity. See, on the one hand, it seems Pilate didn't really want to deal with this messy business. And this might just be a way to pass it on to someone else's desk. Not my circus, not my monkeys, you deal with it. Good. But on the other hand, even if he was going to have to deal with it in the end, Herod, who was the ruler of Galilee, Herod had a better understanding of Jewish matters than Pilate, so he was likely to have more of an idea of the issues at stake. He might be able to give Pilate a steer on what's the right action here. So, verse 7, Pilate sends Jesus off to Herod, who was in town for the Passover festival that was happening. Indeed, Herod may have even been sharing the same large building, the big palace, where Pilate was. Herod might have been at the other end of it. So he sends him off. He sends Jesus off to Herod. I wonder if you can see yourself yet in Pilate so far, or the people. We'll come back to them. But first, let's see who we can see with Herod. Look at verse 8 with me. When Herod saw Jesus, he was greatly pleased, because for a long time he'd been wanting to see him. From what he had heard about him, he hoped to see him perform a sign of some sort. Herod's excited about this. But fascinatingly, in verse 9, Jesus says nothing to Herod. Not a word. He won't answer Herod's questions. And the result of that in verses 10 and 11 is that Herod seems to run out of enthusiasm for Jesus. He was quite excited before, but this is too hard. So he joins in with his soldiers in mocking him instead, dressing him up as a pretend king. Oh, he thinks he's the Messiah, does he? Thinks he's a king. Ha! Some king. King in chains. Back you go to Pilate then, dressed up in your nice gear as a king. Off you go. It's pretty horrible and ironic, given who Jesus actually is. But do you wonder to yourself why Jesus didn't respond to Herod? Why didn't he answer Herod's questions? Doesn't Jesus like to respond to questions? He seems to have through the gospel. Doesn't Jesus like to display who he is? To speak of who he is? Why didn't he respond to Herod? Well, I think it has a lot to do with the attitude that Herod is approaching Jesus with here. Verse 8 says he sought a sign from Jesus. He wanted him to do a trick, wanted him to do some magic. Or perhaps he kind of wanted Jesus to prove who he is on Herod's terms. That when others have sought a sign in this gospel, that's exactly what it's been. It's been like, prove who you are, do it on our terms when we want it because it's a test. Now, there is nothing wrong with asking Jesus to show himself, with honestly investigating Jesus, with asking questions of him. Nothing wrong with that. It's a good thing to do if we do so humbly, recognizing the nature of who it is that we're investigating. Recognizing that by investigating Jesus, we're actually investigating the possibility that this is the Son of God. And so the attitude we take as we investigate should at least include some sort of humility and an openness to who he might be. But if we ask questions like Herod did, from the position of the aggressor, the judge, you know, you show me, Well, that's a very different attitude. And really at that point, we're not conducting our investigation in a way that's fitting with who we're investigating. It's a little bit like this. You imagine you're a keen amateur astronomer. I don't know if any of you are. If you are, I still love you. But imagine you're a keen amateur astronomer. And the time is particularly good. A particularly good time comes around for viewing Jupiter. The perfect conditions arrive for seeing the greatest of all the planets in the solar system. And you have a very powerful telescope that's been made available to you to help with this viewing. So you're very excited. And you invite a friend who's not so keen on astronomy, but your friend says, oh yeah, I'll come and have a look. I've heard Jupiter's quite a big deal. I'll come and have a look. Yep. And so your friend arrives on this clear evening, perfect viewing conditions. And your friend says, okay, I'm here now. Bring Jupiter in then and have it spin for me. And you say, that's not how it works. It's a planet, not a dog. Just look in the telescope and you get an amazing view of this great planet. And they say, I'm not bending over and scrunching up my face and looking in that thing. Why should I have to? If this planet really is so great, if it's such a great planet, it can come to me. I'm ready. Come on. Now, of course, all your friend's going to see is a little white light that looks a bit like a star. And they probably won't be that impressed. Because you won't see the reality of a thing if you won't look in a way that is fitting for what you are looking at. Herod was standing, looking at the greatest one of all, the very morning star himself, looking right at him. But he didn't see who Jesus was because he wasn't willing to inquire with the right attitude. He completely missed the Son of God. Do you see yourself in Herod at all? If we investigate Jesus, we're not going to get an answer if we don't investigate in a way that reflects who it is that we are investigating. If Jesus just might be the Son of God, you want to approach him with a humility that says, please reveal yourself to me, show yourself to me, help me to see. Rather than, show me your tricks, or here are my terms, now meet them and then maybe I'll believe in you. It's a very different thing. So were you there with Herod? Again, perhaps were you there with the people? Because Jesus is sent back to Pilate from Herod. In verse 13, he calls together the Jewish leaders, the chief priests and the rulers, and the people. And Pilate declares in very clear terms again that neither he nor Herod have found any basis for the charges against Jesus. Pilate knows clearly that Jesus doesn't deserve death. But the people cry out in verse 18, away with this man, release Barabbas to us. And then in verse 20, Pilate appeals to them again. But they shout out, crucify him, crucify him. And then yet again, when Pilate declares that there are no grounds in verse 22, no basis for the death penalty, again, the crowd insists. Pilate insists he will release Jesus, I should say. So he cries out again. Pilate says again, there's no grounds, no basis for the death penalty. And again, he insists he'll release Jesus. He says, just with a beating, just a little bit of unjust punishment to appease them. Then in verse 23, the people again demand and insist that Jesus be crucified. Now, this is quite astonishing in many ways. Yes, the injustice of it, but also that the people would act in this way. See, before this, in Luke's gospel, the people, the crowds around Jerusalem, were generally very positive about Jesus. A couple of days before this, the religious leaders had wanted to arrest Jesus, but they couldn't do it. Why? Because Jesus was too popular with the people. It was going to cause a riot. The people liked him too much. Now, the people were calling for Jesus' blood. I wonder if you recognize yourself in them at all. One day, so positive about Jesus. Perhaps it's in church. It's a great morning, great evening. Feels good to follow him. Or perhaps it's because Jesus has said things that you really agree with in the Gospels. Yeah, I agree with that. He's for family values. Yes, he's for justice. He's for looking after the poor. He's for loving your enemy. Yes, I agree with that. I'm all for Jesus. But then he becomes inconvenient. or he says something you don't like so much. Ooh, that pushes on me, I don't like that. Or the opinion of those around you, maybe at work or at school or in the wider culture. Not so positive about him now. Not so positive about the things he stands for, and you're in amongst that. And then before you know it, you're swept along with them. Not so bold for him after all. Not so positive about him after all. Just kind of caught up in the flow of things. It's too hard to go against it. You just go with the crowd and their opinions. You don't stand up against it. Were you there with the people? Or were you there with Pilate? Pilate is a fascinating character. We've seen how clearly he saw Jesus was innocent. He's declared it over and over again. But then we get to verse 23. But with loud shouts, they, the people and the leaders, they insistently demanded that he be crucified, and their shouts prevailed. So Pilate decided to grant their demand. What? He decided to grant their demand. When he was so sure of Jesus' innocence, when he proclaimed it over and over and over again, he granted their demand. Yes, he did. When the shouts got too loud, he lost his nerve. In the end, it was too hard to keep siding with justice, to keep siding with Jesus. So he let his principles go, and he let Jesus go to death. Pilate gave up. Do you see yourself with Pilate? There are very loud voices in our society that shout for things that are not in keeping with Jesus. They make it very hard for us to keep siding with him. They make it very tempting to give up. They say if you won't give up on Jesus and his standards, his view of things, his ways, if you won't give up on those, we don't like them, then you are bad and we don't like you and we're against you. That's what they say. And they keep shouting. And by the way, if you think you can insulate yourself from them, you think you can insulate your kids from them, you are kidding yourself. This is the world we live in. And eventually, sometimes those shouts start resonating in your own head, don't they? I mean, it can be just so hard to keep siding with Jesus, even though you know, really, deep down, you know that he is the way and the truth and the life, but it's so hard to stay with him. Were you there with Pilate? Have you seen yourself then in the story? Perhaps in the soldiers' outright mockery? Perhaps in the Jewish leaders' decided rejection? Or in Herod's unhumble inquiry? In the people getting swept along by the flow of things? Or in Pilate losing his nerve and giving up? Were you there? I was. I was there. But wherever you might have seen yourself in this story, there is one person we should see ourselves with above all. And that is Barabbas. Back in verse 19, we were told that Barabbas was in prison for insurrection and murder. Most of us know what murder is, but what's insurrection? Insurrection is rebellion, causing an uprising. In this case, a murderous uprising, causing a rebellion, stirring up the people against the authorities, a rebellion. Now, what was the charge against Jesus? In the end, it was rebellion, stirring up trouble, being a rival to Caesar, being one who stirs up rebellion. Barabbas was guilty of the very crime that Jesus was accused of, but found overwhelmingly innocent, declared innocent over and over again. Barabbas was guilty of the crime which Jesus was innocent of. And Barabbas, though guilty, went free. Why? Because the innocent one died instead. Verse 25. He, Pilate, released the man who'd been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, the the one they asked for, and surrendered Jesus to their will. Jesus had been quite clear the night before this that he would die for us. He told his disciples to share a meal that would commemorate his body and blood given for you, he said. That is for those who follow him. And at the end of the meal, Jesus said that it was time for him to fulfill a prophecy from chapter 53 of the book of Isaiah in the Bible. He quoted from the end of that prophecy, and he identified himself with the person pictured in it. One who, Isaiah 53 says, would be pierced for our transgressions, for our sins, our wrongdoings, and would be numbered with the transgressors, with those who were guilty. And now, in this trial, one who is clearly innocent is condemned to death, and the guilty one goes free. The one who is clearly innocent is condemned to be pierced for our transgressions, while the guilty one goes free. You and I are Barabbas. We have all, in one way or another, rejected Jesus, God's Messiah, his King. We've ignored him. We've treated him as inconvenient. We've betrayed him when it's unpopular to be identified with him. We've done what he calls us not to do. And so we are rebels. Not the cool kind of rebels who stand up to the man. No, the kind of rebels who disrespect the God who gave us life and his Son, whom he sent to save us in love. And we thumb our nose at his love and say no. That's the kind of rebels we are. We are cosmically guilty of what Barabbas was guilty of and what Jesus was innocent of. And please remember here at this point, especially if you've been in church for a long time, I'm not talking to the person next to you here. I'm talking to you and I'm talking to me. Jesus knew exactly what he was doing, going to the cross, dying in place of you and I. Yes, he was at one level under the power of Pilate, seems like it, doesn't he? Under the power of the Jewish leaders. But he knew what he was doing. He'd said many times before in this gospel, I'm going to Jerusalem and I'm going to be killed. I'm going to be mocked, beaten, and I'm going to be crucified. He knew what he was doing because this is what he came to do. It's how he saves those who are lost. It's how he brings sinners to forgiveness. It's how he brings the outsiders in. It's how he brings us into his kingdom. So we are Barabbas. Wherever you've seen yourself in the story, I entreat you, I beg you, see yourself in Barabbas. Realize you were there with Barabbas. You were in chains. You were on the path to death. And the Son of God looked at you and he loved you and he stepped willingly into your place so you could be free. Accept that. Recognize that. It means accepting you are guilty. Yes, it does. We all need to remember that. It will slow us down before we look on anyone else, by the way, or think, oh, if only they were as good as me, or if they just had the Christian knowledge I have, or if they were as smart as... Barabbas doesn't get to say that. Barabbas doesn't say that. Barabbas says, I'm guilty. But Barabbas gets to look honestly at their sin, at the ways they've failed, at the ways I've even let my Savior down, and say, he died for that. Praise his name. He died to set me free, and now I am free. He died so I don't have to. What wonder is this? Praise his name. Now let me live wholeheartedly to honor him who went to the cross for me. I am Barabbas. Are you? May God help us to see that we are. Amen.